Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, July 29th, 2025, and our dear friend Scott Ritter is back with us. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with what Donald Trump said yesterday. He said that he's not interested in meeting with Vladimir Putin. Here is what he said.
You know, I'm not so interested in talking anymore. We have such nice conversations, such respectful and nice conversations, and then people die the following night with a missile going into a town and hitting, recently, I guess, the nursing home, but they hit other things. Whatever they hit, people die. So, Adam.
Yeah, here is what Medvedev said, Scott, on Twitter, on X, in response to Lindsey Graham. He said, it's not for you or Donald Trump to dictate when to get at the peace table. Negotiations will end when all the objectives of our military operation have been achieved. Work on America first. And you see the way that as time goes by, it seems that this sort of the momentum that the United States had, and I believe they still have it to break a deal with Russia. They're losing. They're somehow, the way that Donald Trump talking about Putin, the way that Lindsey Graham is somehow driving the show behind the scene. Is the momentum getting away from the opportunity, from what's going on between the United States and Russia?
There's never been an opportunity for Donald Trump to get his way with Russia, ever. This was always pie-in-the-sky thinking. There was a chance for the United States to put pressure on Ukraine to accept reality and to put pressure on Europe to stop reinforcing stupidity. And this could have brought about peace, and Donald Trump would have gotten a lot of credit for that peace. But the peace would have been 100% on terms dictated by Russia. Everybody needs to remember, Russia didn't start this war. This war was thrust upon Russia by the collective, by the United States, by Donald Trump, the policies of the first Trump administration. You know, during that time, Russia was actively working to fulfill the promise and the potential of the Minsk Accords. And it was the United States that, you know, continued to send lethal weapons to Ukraine, to train the Ukrainian army to NATO standards for the sole purpose of confronting Russian separatists and Russian forces in the Donbass region. And, you know, according to the pie-in-the-sky thinking of the Ukrainian politicians and their CIA and MI6, masters, Crimea as well, to push Russia to its 1991 frontiers. Trump is to blame here. He's the man who made this possible. The Russians were going to cut slack. I think the Russians were willing to go into temporary amnesia and pretend that Donald Trump was the great peacemaker and not the horrific war maker that he is. The reality, the Russians know the reality, but Russia was never going to yield. They made that clear from the start. Go back to the initial meeting between Marco Rubio and Sergei Lavrov in Riyadh. And they came out saying, well, the Russians have given us reality and we need to yield to everybody. But then they turned around and said, but now we need Russia to make some concessions. And the Russians are like, well, what part of address root cause of the conflict don't you understand? We will make no concessions on that. None, zero. There's no latitude for this. And there's no reason for you to hope that this will be. This was known from the start. And yet Donald Trump, instead of acceding to this reality and telling his policymakers, let's find a policy that meets this reality, get this war over with now, he continued to believe that he had some sort of leverage over Russia, perhaps advised by Scott Bessent, the Secretary of Treasury, who believed that, you know, he could break Russia's economy through sanctioning oil. Steve Kellogg, who believed that they could break Russia's military by continuing to flow weaponry into Ukraine. I mean, these are some of the worst advisors in the world, giving the worst advice in the world to the dumbest president in the world about things Russia. Now he has Lindsey Graham, you know, whispering in his ear as well. Donald Trump is a narcissistic egomaniac. We have to remember that. And if it has to all be about Donald Trump. This is a man who viewed the Russian-Ukrainian conflict not in terms of saving lives. What a hypocrite. you know, he's providing the weaponry that not only kills Russian soldiers, but gets more Ukrainian soldiers killed. He facilitates the continued flow of weaponry into Ukraine that just lengthens this war, complicates this war, but doesn't change the inevitable outcome. The man most responsible for deaths in Ukraine today is Donald Trump. He could have brought this war to an end. You can't expect Russia in an existential struggle, and this is indeed an existential struggle for Russia, to, you know, say, oh, we'll do what the United States wants us to do, even though the United States started this war back in 2014 or even going back further. Russia has a long memory. They know exactly what's happening here. They know exactly what's at stake here. And they're not going to surrender to the United States. They're not going to yield to Donald Trump. So what we're seeing here is Donald Trump throwing a temper tantrum. Again, he's being poorly advised. If he thinks for a second Russia gives one rat's ass about the threat of sanctions, he doesn't know Russia, nor does he understand China, nor does he understand anybody else, any of the other players out there. You know, what we do know is, as we speak, the Ukrainian government is at risk. The confidence in Volodymyr Zelensky is plummeting, and if reports coming out of the Russian intelligence service are true, there's meetings taking place in Switzerland behind the back of Zelensky to, you know, to have him replaced with Zeluzhny, who would just be another failed leader. Because, again, it doesn't recognize reality. Let me just tell you what the reality for Ukraine is. Ukraine will be strategically defeated by Russia. The current government will not exist, either in terms of the presidency or the construct of the Rada, Ukrainian parliament. There will be new elections, and these elections will produce a pro-Russian government beholden to Russia that will seek to transform Ukraine from the failed proxy of the West that it currently is into a member of the Union state. Ukraine will become, like Belarus, a partner of Russia in the framework of what they call the Union state. It's not the Soviet Union, it's something different, but Ukraine will forever be attached to Russia, to Belarus, to the East. It will never be part of Europe. That's the reality. The sooner Donald Trump recognizes this reality, the better, but he's not going to. I mean, look, Tulsi Gabbard, God bless her soul, is out there, you know, doing God's work about exposing the scam of Russiagate. But you know, she's had a deputy appointed. Aaron, I can't remember his last name. He's the new number two at the ODNI, at the Office of Director of National Intelligence. Aaron Jacob, maybe. But he's a Russophobe. Simply, it's a CIA hack. He was the guy advising Trump about Russia in the first term. You know, the guy giving the bad advice about how to arm Ukraine and all that. That's him. He's now the number two guy. There's not anybody advising Donald Trump right now who knows the reality of Russia. They're all enemies of Russia. And as a result, he continues to head to take us down a very dangerous path because, you know, all of this Russophobia, all this reinforcing the paranoia of Europe leads to situation that we experienced, for instance, in Wiesbaden a couple of weeks ago, where Christopher Donahue, the four-star general who commands U.S. forces in Europe and allied forces, sit there and talked openly about how we could take out Kaliningrad, the Russian exclave that used to be part of, former East Prussia, the city of Kaliningrad and the surrounding areas. We could take it out, he said, very quickly. No, you can't. But if you tried, you'd die instantly. Because, gosh, let me remind everybody that Kaliningrad is part of the Russian Federation. And the Constitution of Russia deems it to be such. And the nuclear doctrine of Russia is such that anytime the territorial integrity or the sovereignty of Russia is threatened by nuclear armed powers, that Russia will respond nuclearly. So, Chris Donahue, the quickest way to die, because you will be dead within, say, an hour and a half of making that decision, is to order NATO forces to move on Kaliningrad. You will be hit by either a Russian nuke or an Oreshnik or something, but you'll be dead. So with your entire staff, so the entire command and control structure of NATO. Kaliningrad is Russia. It ain't your toy. It ain't a game. It ain't a soccer ball to be kicked around. And to threaten it, what in God's name do you think we would do if China or Russia threatened Alaska or Hawaii or Texas or California? Kaliningrad is Russia. I mean, these people are stupid, truly stupid. But the dumbest one of all is Donald Trump. Let me make another prediction for you. He says he doesn't want to talk to Vladimir Putin right now. Within 30 days, he'll be making that phone call because his policy is about ready to collapse like a house of cards.
You don't need to have some sort of empathy, sympathy toward Russia. Just put yourself in the shoes of Russians. You can understand that Russia cannot afford losing Ukraine. And losing Ukraine, I mean that NATO puts the troops in Ukraine, puts the weapons in Ukraine. Why is that so difficult for the presidents of the United States to understand what is the main cause? What is the real concern on the part of Russia? It's somehow it's so simple, but when it comes to the presidents of the United States, somehow there are some barriers, there's some obstacles in the way that they think about Ukraine and the policies of Europe together with the United States in Ukraine.
No, Donald Trump understands fully well. This is why he implemented the policies he did in his first term. He knows that the goal is to turn Ukraine into a NATO fist that can strike upwards and threaten Moscow, threaten the Russian strategic center. You know, people need to realize that the Russian Federation is a successor to the Soviet Union in terms of Moscow and the defense of it. Russia was the core element of that. The near abroad, what we call the Baltics states, Ukraine, Georgia, etc., combined with the Warsaw Pact. You know, when Russia's strategic center was defined, it was during the Cold War when you had the Warsaw Pact. So NATO was way the hell out there. You know, Poland was part of the Warsaw Pact. East Germany was. We're talking about NATO, you know, being on the River Elbe. And suddenly, NATO has progressed eastward. People say, well, why does Russia object to NATO? Because every expansion of NATO brought NATO capabilities that much closer to Russia's strategic depth. And Ukraine is literally, if you carve that out, you are just thrusting NATO straight into the stomach of Russia. Russia can't accept this. Can't accept this at all, especially given the hostile nature that, you know, the attitude, the posturing of NATO toward Russia. It just isn't going to happen. It's not going to be allowed to happen. And yet, this is the policy that Trump was trying to implement during his first term. Trump knows damn well what's at stake here. He's just playing stupid games. The Russians, I think, had hoped that Trump would actually back away from the failed policies of the past and recognize that, you know, you can't have Ukraine and NATO. And indeed, early on, you heard Trump administration people talk about that. But then they keep talking as if Zelensky is going to be the president, or a Zelensky-like figure is going to be the president, that Ukraine is going to be this entity that still maintains its Banderist connectivity and has this military linkage. I mean, if you're not talking about the absolute demilitarization of Ukraine, what you create is a NATO nation in everything but the legal stamp of approval. It's a huge NATO army equipped with NATO weaponry capable of striking Russia's strategic depth. That's what Trump wants. That's what he wants. He knows what he wants because he helped design it in his first term. He was briefed by the CIA. This is why they built 20 bases in Ukraine. He was briefed by the Pentagon. This is why they trained the Ukrainian army. Trump knows what's at stake here. That's the hypocrisy of it all. The Russians had hoped that he wouldn't. But what Trump does every day is exposes the fact that he's a lying sack of cow manure who cannot be trusted at all by anybody, especially the Russians. I mean, and this pains me to say, because we really do need to have better relations with this Russian government. This Russian government is ready and willing to sit down and, you know, talk about a new way forward with the United States, normalization of relations. But in order to do that, we have to stop this notion that we can strategically defeat Russia or position ourselves to strategically defeat Russia. Russia will have nothing to do with it. We wouldn't allow it. We wouldn't allow it. Would we allow, you know, China to come into Mexico and carve away Texas right there, with all the Chinese weapons ready to strike into the American strategic depth? Hell no, we wouldn't allow that. Why in God's name do we think Russia is going to allow NATO to make a move on Ukraine? It's just stupid.
Can the United States be great not having Russia and China as the enemy, as the enemy of the United States?
Can we? Sure. I mean, fact is, it's the only way the United States will be great. The United States will not be great by its military. Its military is destroying it. I mean, this military is supposed to protect the United States, is destroying the United States. It's putting us into a state of bankruptcy. It alienates us with the world. It causes us to behave in ways that aren't conducive to a new multipolar reality. And it puts us on the track towards wars we can't afford to fight. Literally, all this technological supremacy we brag about, it costs money. And as we just proved with the 12-day war between Israel and Iran, we can't afford it. I mean, we ate up 25% of our THAAD missile stocks. Those are the missiles supposed to shoot down all the Russian missiles, the Chinese missiles, if we ever go to war against Russia and China. We just used 25% of them to help defend Israel against not even Iran's, you know, B team in terms of ballistic missile capability. Our SM-3 stocks, we haven't been producing SM-3s because we haven't been in a war like this, but they're very expensive missiles, and we just blew through them. We can't build them very fast. The fact is, any Pentagon planner, any Pentagon logistician will sit there and should be advising people, we can't sustain a high-intensity conflict against a peer-level force like Russia and China for more than a week. And then we run out of everything. We run out of everything. And that's the reality of it. We've built this hugely expensive military that, you know, we have enough money to gold plate it. But when the veneer is cut through, we're down to cardboard, baby, because that's all that's left. This is not the path to greatness. The path to greatness is normalization of relations, normal economic, not this garbage that Trump just pulled off with the EU, the biggest scam ever. I mean, just think about it. There's nothing about the deal real. Ursula von der Leyen cannot commit Europe to $600 billion in investment in America. So it's a lie. There's nobody there lining up. There's nobody there lining up to give America $600 billion. So it's a lie, straight up lie. Isn't going to happen. The $760 billion in energy, I mean, we don't have that much energy to sell Europe, even if we wanted to. It's not how the system works. And even if we did, Europe's paying 3 to 4 times as much for this. In order to commit to $760 billion from the United States, they have to cut off, for instance, the gas they buy from Norway. It's not just about delinking itself from Russia. I think, what, $23 billion worth of petroleum products were sold last year. But it means Norway. In order to commit to this, you have to stop buying cheap Norwegian gas and you have to buy this hugely expensive American gas. I mean, it might not cost America much to produce it, but by the time we, you know, liquefy it, put it on ships, bring it over, deliquefy, get it into the system and all that stuff, 3 to 4 times as much as the Norwegian stuff. The Norwegian stuff's more expensive than the Russian stuff. And this is what Europe has signed up to. It's not going to happen. And by the way, we don't have $760 billion worth of liquid natural gas products to sell to Europe. And they couldn't buy it even if we did. It's a scam, a setup, fake, fraud, a con. But this is America. We can't be great doing this. I mean, my God, I'm not sympathetic. You know, the Europeans, they built their own ship. They shot the holes in the hull and it's sinking. That's on them. But I hate to see people debase themselves like this. I mean, as much as I despise Ursula von der Leyen, to watch her I think we're back. To watch her debase herself in this fashion is nobody wants to see that. What we'd like to see is normal relations. And in fact, if we want to have normal, healthy relations with Europe, we can't be engaged in this sort of thing. Europe needs to have trust in us. how is this a trustworthy partner? We're a colonial power overlording over Europe. It's just, it's sickening. Every aspect of how Donald Trump relates with our erstwhile friends and allies is sickening, sickening. It sickens me.
We know that during the Biden administration, Starmer was asking the Biden admin, if you remember the that meeting between the Biden administration and Starmer, they were asking some sort of permission from the US government to attack Russia, to hit deeper into the Russian soil. It seems that even not having that sort of connection between the Trump administration and Europeans, they're getting that from the Trump administration. When you look at the attack on nuclear bombers in Russia, it's not something small to be ignored. It's something big. Russia is not just panicking. The way that Russia is behaving doesn't diminish the importance of what has happened. Do you feel that we have some sort of sanity in the Pentagon? Because I see this problem coming from Pentagon and the sort of reports that they're giving, the sort of information they're giving Donald Trump. Because we had Pentagon going against Biden, going and deciding not to escalate against Russia. But you don't see that role coming from Pete Hegseth and anybody from Pentagon. At least we can say that nothing is coming out but some sort of propaganda about drones making new weapons. And you don't see any sort of strategic thinking or Pete Hegseth putting out something more sane when it comes to the war in Ukraine.
Well, actually, Hegseth did. I mean, in the aftermath of the 12-day war between Iran and Israel, Hegseth took a look at the expenditure of munitions and the drawdown that's already taken place in American stockpiles, and he said, we're not sending anything else to Ukraine. He was overridden. The man who seems to be in charge now is Mike Ratcliffe, the director of the CIA. I mean, there was a meeting where Donald Trump turned to Ratcliffe, bypassing Hegseth and saying, hey, what are we going to be able to get those weapons there? And all, I mean, it's all a lie. Again, everything about Trump is a lie. 17, Patriot batteries, the full complement. They don't exist. But the point is, Ratcliffe took the lead on this, not Hegseth. I believe the Pentagon continues to be staffed with professionals who, their job is to, lay out the reality of war. The attack on the Russian strategic bombers was a British affair run by British intelligence, maybe backed by the CIA. The CIA is a rogue entity right now, absolutely rogue, out of control. And I think what Trump is doing right now is turning to the iron here, turning to Ratcliffe and to the Russian Mission Center and saying, turn up the screws. He tends to forget it was the Russian Mission Center that helped create the BS narrative that was used to weaponize against him, or at least aspects of it. I know there were some people who questioned some of the intelligence, but the point is, I mean, Trump is just confused. He's just a confused man right now. These drone attacks that are taking place in Russia right now, they're all planned by the British, 100% planned by the British. The Germans are facilitating with some technologies, et cetera. But this is a British operation, and you have Trump meeting with the Brits, being briefed on by the Brits. He understands what's going on. He may now decide to allow Ukraine to use the ATACMS to a greater range. I think people should be reminded. Again, I can't speak for the Russian government, nor would I ever be advising the Russian government on what to do. But one, has to keep in mind that when Meshnik was fired back in November, it was a weapon system under development, meaning that the system that was fired was not a production missile. It was a missile that had already undergone certain testing. It was ready for operational testing. But it was a missile that had, the booster taken from this missile, the second stage taken from this missile, the post-boost vehicle modified from this missile, and then handmade dispensing, mechanisms and purpose-built, submunitions. It was all sort of a pre-production missile put together. They fired it and it worked. And at that point in time, Putin signed off on it and said, turn it into, you know, full-scale production. Now Putin has announced that the Oreshnik is in serial production. That means that all those components that were used in the Oreshnik, instead of, you know, being pulled one of and modified, they now have a production line. So it's not just the Vodkins machine building plant that's assembling this. It's, you know, a propulsion center outside of Moscow. It's a, you know, guidance center in outside of Perm. It's a, you know, warhead center outside of Chelyabinsk. They all have now production lines dedicated to this. The entire system has come together and now it flows into Vodkinsk, gets turned into a serially produced missile, which then gets turned over to the Russian military. And the reason why I bring all this up is that if the Russians decide to unleash the Oreshnik, it's not going to be one missile. I mean, the Ukrainians are playing with fire here. And I think Putin has come out and said just the other day that if Europe or Germany participates directly or indirectly in an attack against Russia, Ukraine will be the target of Russian retaliation. So I think you will see the Oreshnik brought in, not in a single fire, but we're talking about a sustained barrage of Oreshniks that will just level Ukraine. That's the direction we're heading here. You know, up until now, Russia's probably, you know, held back on that in hopes that Donald Trump would do the right thing. But if Trump is stupid enough to allow ATACMS to be used, you know, this goes back to the situation that exists in the fall of 2024 when the Biden administration signed off on this very insanity. People should remember what the reality was at that time. In November, I think it was Rear Admiral Radcliffe is the CIA director. I can't remember his name. Butler, something like that. He's the plans guy for Buchanan, Rear Admiral Buchanan, director of plans for Strategic Command. That's our nuclear armed forces. And he gave a briefing to CSIS in Washington, D.C., where he answered some questions. And basically, he said that the United States is prepared to engage in a nuclear exchange with Russia. That means a limited nuclear war with Russia. And he said, we're prepared to win. He said something else that maybe the government should be more honest with the American people about what winning means. Because he said, if we have a nuclear exchange with Russia and we win, life will never be the same for Americans ever again. Meaning the thing we call life that we all love, it'll be totally different because we'll be living in a nuclear wasteland, no electricity, no food supplies, martial law, no freedom, no nothing. That's the future for fighting a nuclear exchange with Russia. Now, people say, well, that's just planning. I mean, he's just a planning. Well, except that it's not just that, because the Russians had said that if the Biden administration allows these long-range ATACMS strikes, that their nuclear doctrine will be brought into play. And they published a new nuclear doctrine, I think, in late November, early December. There was a briefing held at Congress. The CIA went around and briefed. And I ended up talking to a very senior Democrat who was present at this briefing. And I asked, I said, I know you can't give away national secrets and I wouldn't ask you to, but the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, they all say that the CIA assessed that Russia was bluffing. I said, is that what the CIA said? Did they believe that Russia was bluffing about the nukes? And this very senior Democrat said, no, the CIA said the exact opposite, just not bluffing. That if these ATACMS are used, Russia, if the wrong targets are hit, Russia will use nuclear weapons against NATO. He said, that's not the scary part. The scary part was the Biden administration, senior Biden administration people in the briefing saying, we're ready for this. So Buchanan's briefing wasn't just theoretical. Buchanan's briefing was, we're ready to go to war. And there are people saying there was a better than 50% chance we were going to have a nuclear war at the end of last year. Better than 50% chance. The only thing that saved it was Donald Trump coming out. He gave a Time Magazine interview where he said, if I'm president, I won't continue this ATACMS thing. And that allowed the Russians to say, okay, we don't need to go into nuclear war right now. We'll wait for the next, for the new president to come in and he'll end this stupidity. We just have to ride this thing out. Russia's been riding out stupidity like the Ukrainian drone attack against their strategic bombers. That should have brought about an immediate nuclear response by doctrine. They attacked Russia's nuclear bombers. So it should have been the end of a lot, but the Russians are behaving responsibly. They're behaving responsibly because they're still holding out hope that Donald Trump will do the right thing and stop this insanity. But now Trump says he doesn't want to talk to Putin. So my guess is that Trump is going to do the dumbest thing possible and authorize the Ukrainians to use long-range strike missiles. And they're going to do that, and then Russia's going to flatten Ukraine using Oreshniks. And then Donald Trump's going to make a panicked phone call to Vladimir Putin to try and stop World War III. We were close to 50%, over 50%. There's a greater than 50% chance of a nuclear war last fall. Straight up. Not exaggeration. If Donald Trump allows long-range strike, we're back to that level of stupidity. Better than 50% chance of nuclear war. Do we really want to roll the dice? I mean, this is why you have to question who's advising the president. Because I think Trump continues to believe that the Russians are bluffing, because the Russians have absorbed these attacks and just continue, you know, pressing home on a winning formula. But Russia can only take so much. And at some point in time, when you cross a certain line, I mean, already you have these British directed drones, you know, taking out critical infrastructure. Fortunately, it's, you know, it's a harassment, but it's not actually harming Russia in terms of their strategic economic capabilities. But if the ATACMS starts coming in, striking command and control centers, logistics centers, and things of that nature, the gloves come off. And I think you're going to see destruction in Ukraine like you've never seen before. And then the next thing the Russians will say is the next strike is nuclear, and it won't be limited to Ukraine. And that's when Trump will make the phone call. So he can sit here and, you know, and sit there and say, I'm really not feeling like a phone call right now. Too bad, Donnie baby. You know, it ain't going to be Russia calling you, by the way. You know, it isn't going to be Vladimir Putin saying, please talk to me, please. It's going to be Donald Trump sending a panic message. I need to talk to Putin now. We need to end this war now. And Putin's going to say, we end it the way we always said we're going to end it. And this time I think Donald Trump says yes, and we move forward. But what it takes us to go right up to the edge of the nuclear abyss to achieve this common sense, you know, solution. The war could end today, right now, without playing nuclear, you know, roulette.
It seems, Scott, that Europeans, the way that they're playing with Donald Trump, it seems they say, let Donald Trump feel that he's in charge, he's running the show, but we know what we're doing in the case of Ukraine. And Donald, somehow, you see Starmer? Did you see how Starmer was behaving? Look at, you mentioned Ursula von der Leyen. You talk about the NATO Secretary General. These people are, when they sit next to Donald Trump, it seems that a little kid is beside Donald Trump. And it's unbelievable, but it seems that this is a game on their part. They know what they're doing with Donald Trump, in my opinion.
And no, Donald they don't
Trump
know what
somehow doesn't with know what's going on.
They don't know what they're doing with Donald Trump. They don't know what they're doing, period. You think Starmer's in charge? What's he in charge of? He's a failed leader. He's under tremendous political pressure at home. He has no respect. His party despises him. His nation despises him. Macron is a joke, a walking joke, under threat. His parliament may collapse this summer at any moment. I mean, they're bankrupt. They're doing stupid things. Unsustainable. Even the German, I mean, look at Merz, you know, the moron of morons. I'm sorry, my wife is listening to this and she's going to shoot me. She keeps telling me I have to behave more like Doug McGregor and like Colonel Wilkerson, you know, esteemed statesmen and all this. I ain't one of them. I mean, I wish I was. You know, they were both colonels. You know, I was just a stupid captain slash major, and I went around and pissed everybody off. And that's what I'm going to continue to do, because you have to call it the way you see it. There's no room for diplomacy here. Merz is one of the worst not only worst human beings in the world, I mean, he's up there with Netanyahu, and Trump is just really dastardly, but he's stupid. He had to sit there and give a speech yesterday. Did you see his speech? Or he had to admit, I'm destroying the German economy. Straight up, we're ruining it. Yep, this is bad. It's going to be bad. It's all over. At the same time, he's trying to convince the Germans to become the Fourth Reich. I mean, he's not long for this world, too. And that normally that kind of behavior would get an immediate vote of no confidence. I mean, so you're telling me the Europeans know what they're doing? They don't know what they're doing domestically, let alone how to handle this out of control, narcissistic maniac, Donald Trump. Starmer pooped his pants going to meet Trump. You know what Starmer would have done? I'll tell you what Keir Ritter would have done. Hey, Donnie, I'm on my way. Let's call up the Scottish police. We got any outstanding complaints on that property there? Yeah, noise complaints, any paperwork not done? I want you to go in, and we're going to seize the palace while Trump's in it. Yeah. And then I'm going to go stay in a hotel. And as you evict the president from a place, because it's Scottish, it ain't American soil. It's Scottish. That means it's mine. Evict that son of a bitch from that freaking place. Kick him out. Close down the golf course. Blow it up. Do whatever you want. Get his ass out of there in the street. And then I'll make him crawl to my hotel and make him come to me as I sit on a chair that's 3 inches taller than him. Yeah, Mr. President, you want to play stupid games? I can play stupid games. That's what a sovereign leader does. If somebody comes into my country and acts like he's a freaking king, you put his ass down. You take him down. That's what you do. Air Force One ain't taking off. Sorry, we closed the runway. Didn't know we had an explosive demolition at the end of it. It's not, nope, you're not going anywhere, Mr. President. That's how you treat a narcissistic egomaniac. But instead, he played his game. He let Donald Trump, you know, have this big estate, and then Keir Starmer comes in crawling like he's visiting a king. Trump ain't a king. He's an American president. That's a powerful position. But at the end of the day, there's no royalty here. Europe is failing. But we saw this. We saw this. It's not just Donald Trump. It's how Europe has failed in front of America. You remember Olaf Scholz sitting in the White House as Biden said, I'm going to blow up the Nord Stream pipeline. At that point in time, Scholz just knocks the microphone off and says, over my dead body, Mr. President, you 60,000 American troops in Germany, you attack Nord Stream, we arrest them all. You want to go to war against us? Go to war. Mobilize your pathetic country. I'll declare clerical fire protection under NATO, and you have to go to war against NATO. That's what you do against a bully, but Europe just sits there and takes it. And there's no reason for them to take it. I keep hearing, you know, America doesn't control anything. Nothing. Our economy is in tatters. Look how China broke us. You just saw today, you know, the White House. China and the United States have agreed to extend the tariff thing. China's like, screw you. We don't care. You want to play games? Yeah, extend it all you want. We don't care. We're not playing your game. We already did, and we won. Remember, we pulled the rare minerals, all those little, you know, permanent magnets that you need to make everything work. We control, we own, we got it all, baby. And we told you you're not getting any of it, and you crawled back to us, and we're there. And you want to put sanctions on us now, threatening Russia? We're going to buy a whole bunch of Russian oil. If I were the Chinese, just tell me, we're buying all the Russian oil in the world. And the moment you put Lindsey Graham's insane sanctions on, we cut you off from, and you're never getting them back this time. You're never getting them back. It's a permanent plug, permanent pull. This is the way you treat the American bully. And Trump folds every single time. Every single time he folds. Why Europe continues to fold, I don't get it. Starmer, he would be the most popular prime minister in England if he sent a police raid on Trump's property in Scotland and took it over and just said, yeah, we got to go through the paperwork. We don't think you've done it right, Mr. President. Do that. We deserve it. We deserve it. America deserves it at this point in time. I hate to say that, but we do. Our arrogance is just discrediting to us as a people, as a collective. And we have this buffoon out there acting as if he's some sort of royal king. I'm all about America first. I'm an American. I want good things for America. But my God, what happened to fair play? What happened to decency? What happened to honor? What happened to integrity? What happened to the rule of law? What happened to the things we're supposed to stand for as a nation? This man represents everything that's the exact opposite of that.
Scott, you've mentioned Europeans, but in the United States, you see people like Lindsey Graham. It's somehow, do they really believe that what they're doing is going to make America great? It's going to make America better? It's going to let America to be improved in terms of the foreign policy, in terms of internal policy and external policy? So what is the agenda? It's all about their personal life, the way that they see themselves, or there is some sort of a strategy for the United States? Because after all, when you seek wars in the Middle East, when you seek wars against China, Russia, how can you imagine that the United States would be great to go to war against these countries? How can someone imagine that? And at the end, believes that he wants to make America great or greater.
You know, unfortunately, American politics has broken the United States of America. I mean, the politics of getting elected and staying elected has corrupted everything. There was a time when a senator, you know, there's a reason why our founding fathers made the Senate term 6 years. They were supposed to be elected, not have to worry about continuous cycles of re-election. They could have time to think, free of the political pressure. You know, the old wise men, now old wise women, and all this stuff. But that's not how this works, because even as a senator, you have to play the party game. You have to be raising money for the party. You have to be pimping for the party, your party. That means that never once do you ever get to do what's right for America. And I will tell you right now, there's not a senator out there that does what's right for America. Every senator does what's either right for their
party. Yeah.
We're back? Okay.
You said every senator does what is in the benefit of
them, of getting them elected. Yeah. They don't do anything for America. There's not a senator today that does what's good for America. Not a single one. And there's not a representative today that whose sole posture is, I'm doing what's good for America. The representatives, they only do that which will get them reelected. There's a handful of exceptions who have such a very strong base of support that they can do things. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Massey, these are exceptions, but the vast majority of them are so insecure as to their position, and they keep looking at the upcoming midterm election. My God, how do I stay in power? What do I need to do to raise the money to stay in power? They don't read the bills. They do what the system tells them to do. If you're a Republican, you do what the Republican whip tells you to do. If you're a Democrat, you do what the Democrat whip, because that's where your money comes from to stay elected. Money has destroyed the American democracy, destroyed it. Absolutely. And what happens is you get these long-term, you know, legacy senators like Graham, who, because they own the money machine in the state that they represent, in this case, South Carolina, and because they have become so intertwined into the moneyed aspects of their national party apparatus, they're virtually untouchable. Because they will always get the backing of the party. They will always get the money of the party. And there's nobody who can rise up to challenge them unless they make a huge mistake. And this is what Graham's doing. But he's wrapped himself in the flag as if he's some sort of hyper-patriotic American. He's not. Lindsey Graham has sold his soul to the military-industrial complex. This is about Lindsey Graham doing that which enriches his corporate sponsors. Lockheed, Raytheon, things of this nature, Israel, you know, he's a big, you know, pro-Israel. That's it. If you parse out Lindsey Graham's policies, they are horrible for America, and they're not grounded in reality at all. They make the world a much more dangerous place. They put the lives of the American service members who honor us with their service at risk at a higher degree. They inch us towards a nuclear war. all of this disguised as patriotism and making America great, it makes America weaker, because here's the other reality is that nothing Graham is proposing is going to succeed. It's going to fail dramatically. I think even Trump recognizes that, that if he goes out and he tries to do all these sanctions that are being threatened, it will fail dramatically. And then he'll be the one who, you know, has mud on his face. But no, these people don't think they're helping America. Lindsey Graham knows who he's helping. He's helping Lindsey Graham. He's helping his cabal of, American politicians who have sold their soul to the military-industrial complex. That's what he's doing. This isn't about helping America or making America great again. This is about weakening America for the benefit of Lindsey Graham.
Do they still believe if they make a deal with Russia, that would be a bad sign for China? That's why, can you say it is the main reason that Donald Trump was somehow convinced to continue to support in Ukraine?
Yeah, I think that's one of the simplistic, world visions that exists in Washington, D.C. today, is that the United States can somehow repeat what Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger did with China and the Soviet Union back in the 70s to drive a wedge between the two. Look, if you get into purely academics, purely academic exercise, there's no doubt that there's a tremendous amount of fear inside Russia about China. I mean, you go out to the Russian Far East, and it's one of the most thinly populated regions in the world, right across the border, a billion Chinese. And they're very concerned about getting swamped by the Chinese. So there's always some sort of hesitation there. But post-2022 changed this. I mean, I traveled to Novosibirsk in 2023. And saw the economic miracle that is Novosibirsk, and saw the extent to which Chinese investment played a role in this economic miracle. I think the Russians and the Chinese now have worked their way through systemic racism. I mean, the Russians were racist against China, and I don't mean in terms of black and white here in America, but there was a prejudice against the Chinese. Not anymore. China has stepped up to the plate. China has been there for Russia. The Russian economy today is succeeding because of China. You could see it. Again, this is anecdotal, and I don't know if you could, testify for Congress that this is the game-winning argument. But again, when I was there, I remember in January of last year, 2024. The taxi drivers who used to, when you ordered a taxi in Russia, they're sort of high-end snobs, and they'll bring in their Mercedes and their BMWs, and they all got advanced Mercedes and BMWs. But now the taxis that were showing up were these advanced Chinese models. And I would ask the guys, I said, why'd you go Chinese? He said, hard to get spare parts for the Mercedes and BMW under sanctions. And he said, but these are really cool cars. They're really good cars. I mean, they're really good cars. And they had features, for instance, in the windows. There's a screen, and as you drive by the advertising or the like billboards and all that stuff, you get a translator. And they translate them into English. So you're driving there and you're like, oh, so that's what that billboard says. Oh, so that's what that sign says. Oh, I'm like, my God. I mean, and this is in Moscow that this is happening. But it's not, it's everywhere. These cars are everywhere. You go to Ekaterinburg, they're there. You go to Irkutsk, they're there. I mean, Moscow, they're there in larger numbers. It's a bigger city. But the Chinese have penetrated the Russian market with high quality goods. And they've also enabled the Russians to build their own industrial depth, their own economic depth, whereas they used to be beholden to Western investments, Western companies. Thanks to sanctions and the divorce that took place, Russia has built up its own companies to fill the vacuum. And Putin and everybody else has said, if we normalize relations with the United States, all the companies that think they're coming back aren't coming back because you left. And when you left, that Russian company formed up and now they're doing pretty good business because you left and you're not coming back. I shouldn't talk good about the Russian economy. The FBI gets mad at me. But
they have changed the market in Russia. I think I can understand that because it's happening as I talk to you. It's happening here in Brazil, Scott.
Yeah. Well, China. I mean, let's just talk about Brazil for a second, because I use this as, and you can correct me if you think I've got this wrong. But you know, the one of the things the United States want to do is, and the pressure they put on Brazil is, you know, we control the Suez, or not the Suez Canal, I'm sorry, the Panama Canal, and all that container traffic through there. We're gonna choke off the Brazilians, you know. Well, China went and built one of the biggest damn ports in Peru, and then they connected that big damn port with a rail line to Brazil, and so. The Chinese now bring in the biggest container ships in the world, purpose-built for this port. They come into this port, which rapidly offloads the containers, loads them on trains, which then go into Brazil, and it's quicker than going through the Panama Canal, cheaper, more efficient. And what it means is that China now is dominating the Brazilian economy, and there's nothing American can do to stop it. Nothing. Am I wrong? Did I get it wrong?
No. You're totally right. it's got the way that China is investing in Brazil. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And it's good for Brazil. I think it's good for Brazil because the Chinese, they're not perfect. Let's not pretend that anybody in this world is perfect. They're businessmen. They want to make a profit, et cetera. But my understanding is that their business deals are pure business deals. They don't come with, you know, moralistic strings attached. You have to, you know, sign on to this abortion policy. You have to do this. You know, it's just straight up business. And that doesn't mean they can't negotiate an unfair deal. They do. They drive hard bargains. And, that has to be watched out in any business, but there's no strings attached when it comes to, you know, well, you have to put a military base here. You have to do this. The CIA is going to come in and ask you for favors here. That's how we work. We can't do a clean business deal with anybody. I mean, Brazil, every time we want to do a business with Brazil, there are strings attached to that deal. And the Chinese just like, now the Chinese are smart because they understand that if you become heavily involved in the trade of Brazil, certain things happen automatically. You don't have to ask for them to happen. They just happen because it's the smart thing to do. And China will become more heavily involved in it. But the amount of infrastructure development that China can bring to bear. And when you talk about green economy, I mean, you know, in the West, that's become sort of a dirty word because of the way the Greens have ruined Europe and in the United States, underfunded, it gets a bad rap. China's one of the greenest places in the world right now. I mean, they are rapidly transitioning on a scale. And if you could take that and bring it to Brazil, I mean, maybe the savior of the Brazilian rainforest will be the Chinese. You know, I mean, maybe. It ain't going to be America. It's not going to be Europe. The Chinese seem to have a solution. And I wish it was the United States taking that lead. I'm an American. I'm proud of being an American. I wish we were the ones doing that. And we could have. But right now, I don't think we can compete with the Chinese in Brazil. I think the Chinese have us beaten hands down. And we're just screwing it up, too, by threatening Brazil with secondary sanctions. Didn't Lula just say, if you don't want to trade with us, we won't trade with you. We don't care. And why? Because they got a Chinese trading partner right now that'll pick up all the slack. And it's not theoretical. The biggest port in Peru is able to fill the Brazilian market with whatever the Brazilian hearts want.
Yeah. Scott, do you feel that with what's going on in Ukraine, if you were to evaluate, if you were to assess or somehow predict what would happen, do you think that this war gonna continue to 2026, 2027, or you see something would happen at the end of this year and we would have some sort of, because I don't see Donald Trump. What is positive in my opinion about Donald Trump? He wants something, he wants solutions to as soon as possible. He doesn't want to play around, but it doesn't seem that
was not a solution. It's just because it's soon as possible. It's not a, to be a solution, you have to solve the problem. What he wants is to be seen as the problem solver. He wants a facade that allows him to posture himself as a big peacemaker so he can get the Nobel Peace Prize. Literally, it's as simple as that. Donald Trump wants the Nobel Peace Prize. That's what this is all about. And he's frustrated because Vladimir Putin is denying him the peace prize that Donald Trump deserves. But again, I mean, my problem is I'm an American. And I know that
yeah, it seems you know
my problem is I'm an American. The FBI jumps in. But no, but for instance, in the Marine Corps, if I'm launching an attack and I take my objective and I, you know, punch through the lines, there will be a follow-through exploitation attack. I mean, we will, you know, seek to build on this success and push through, maintain the momentum, et cetera. But that's the old way. I mean, I didn't fight in drone warfare. I don't understand. I mean, I theoretically, conceptually understand what drone warfare is, but practically I've never experienced it. So I don't know how a swarm of drones can actually just stop your attack. So my brain continues to be programmed to be thinking of, you know, If you take the objective, you mush through, you outflank, you roll up the flanks, you seek the big envelopment, the whole of this. That's not the way this war is being fought. So we have to take that into consideration. The Russians are fighting a war of attrition based on gradual gains on the battlefield designed to inflict as much harm on the Ukrainian military as possible while minimizing the harm done on the Russians. That means that this war could be a forever war. If the Ukrainians can sustain the attrition to the point that they don't break, then it just continues to grind. But then this war is also an economic war. We see that Ukraine is, their economy is gone. They literally have no economy. It's totally subsidized by the West. And so now it becomes a political problem in the West. How, from the Russian perspective, how do we get the West to start squeezing Ukraine? And, you know, Let's dig into this this Russian report released by the SVR, I think today. You know, they say some interesting things in there. I personally view this as an information operation, meaning that no intelligence service freely publishes classified information for the good of the public. They don't. Tulsi Gabbard isn't releasing the information about you know, Russiagate because it's in the public interest. She's doing it for political purposes. She's serving her political boss. He wants it released because it's good for him. The SVR released this because there's a larger information operation being played here. They want to bring down Zelensky. That's their goal. That's their objective. But the Russians are also sophisticated players. Within the narrative that they've constructed in this report, it could be true, it could be fabricated, be a combination of the two. I don't know. Zelensky, you know, in signing the law to shut down these corruption investigatory bodies, this has resonated domestically and abroad. Domestically, we have the demonstrations. Abroad now, we have I think it's the European Union saying, if you don't reverse this, if you don't get the corruption investigations back up, we're going to sanction you, cut off financial support. That's what the Russians want the whole time. This was a very sophisticated information operation that came out. Again, it could all be true. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that no intelligence services publishes something in the public to inform the public. They do it to achieve results. This result is to lower confidence. Zelensky created a divide between Zelensky and Yermak to actually undermine the prospects of Zaluzhny by linking him to American intelligence, which means that Zaluzhny is not a servant of the people, but a servant of the American masters, therefore an extension of Zelensky. But it also is designed to bring about a loss of confidence on the West and Ukraine, to starve it economically. Because if you can start denying Ukraine the only thing that keeps their economy going, which is foreign and, you know, foreign aid, now you have economic collapse. So you have military collapse at the front, you have economic collapse, and then you're looking for political collapse. And that's the other thing that's happening right here with the demonstrations in the street. We're looking at the demise of Zelensky. He's on his way out. When all this is going to happen, I don't know. I can tell you it's happening. You know, the Russians, they have to play a very sophisticated game here. You know, a lot of us look at the battlefield and say, why aren't they doing more on the battlefield? Well, because the Russians have to be prepared for what happens if Trump does put sanctions on. You know, what have, if you do too much on the battlefield, you can not only solidify the resistance in Europe, but you can also alienate those who support you. I mean, some, like North Korea, I don't think will ever be alienated. The Chinese now are more and more on Russia's side. But there's a period of time there where the Chinese were sort of like, we really want to support you, but we're not fans of this war, you know. And so if Russia overreacted, did too much on the military front, they alienate the Chinese. They need that foundation. So the Russians are managing all of this. And they also have to manage the political collapse of Ukraine. It has to be done in a manner which is conducive to implementation, full implementation of the Russian plan. If you create a vacuum too quick, Europe might panic and seek to fill that vacuum, and now you have a greater conflict. You need the collapse to be handled in a managed fashion, because I believe that the next president of Ukraine might be named Azarov. Former prime minister who is, heavily involved in the union state right now. Why would a former prime minister of Ukraine be involved in the union state? Because I believe the future goal, the Russia's goal for Ukraine's future is to have Ukraine to be a member of the union state. To make that happen, though, you need things to fall into place. That means that you have to manage the political collapse of Ukraine so that you can rapidly insert what you want. You can't have a vacuum appear out of nowhere before you're ready to move in. So the Russians are playing a very complicated game. They're not driven by the calendar. You know, this game went, because Russia's looking at the long term. In the long term, they need Ukraine to be stable and part of the Union state. That's Russia's goal and objective, even though they haven't stated it. I believe it is, because that gives Russia the maximum security, the maximum stability, and it keeps Europe forever out of Ukraine, which is very important. But this has to be managed very, very carefully. And so for that reason, I'm not going to give you when this is going to happen. The Russians have said this war will go on as long as it needs to go on. They are going to continue to do what they do at the front, but they also have to keep in mind, you know, what happens if Trump signs the ATACMS bill and an ATACMS missile hits a nuclear command and control center. You know, Russia can't be too extended on the battlefield or too extended here. Russia has to keep everything under control so that any option that materializes can be handled effectively. And so for that reason, you know, look, Zelensky could collapse within 30 days. Zelensky could last another year. The Ukrainian economy may not survive this winter. It may. Ukrainian military, we already see, look at Pokrovsk. You know, the Ukrainians had a solid wall of troops there backed up by drones. The Russians blew the hell out of the drones. They annihilated the troops. And now the Russian infiltrators are able to make through their way in the line into the city center and then dig in. And the Ukrainians don't have enough troops to kick them out. That's the reality. Now, to come in, to reinforce Pokrovsk, they don't have a strategic reserve anymore. You can thank Kursk and the British genius of Kursk. They now have to pull these forces away from Zaporizhia, or, you know, maybe up by Izium, bring them down, but there's no one to replace those gaps. And so now the Russians, because they have manpower superiority everywhere, push forward there. Again, not the big arrows, just a village here, a village here. As Garland Nixon likes to say, every morning you wake up and there's just another story about a Russian soldier raising a Russian flag over a village or town in Ukraine that you can't pronounce. That's the reality. Every morning, Russian flags are going up all across. And that's the way this war is going to go until it's over.
I think with the concept that you mentioned about Russia and their sort of strategy in Ukraine, it doesn't seem from the signs that we've seen so far, it doesn't seem that the British intelligence would be happy to have Zelensky in the next 2 months. They want Zelensky to be removed, and they know who's going to be the next. And that doesn't fit to the strategy of the Russian government.
Well, but look at the Russian intelligence report today. That's why it was released. The Russians aren't stupid. They're actually very sophisticated. This report, I know I'm pissing off a lot of Russians because I'm supposed to be the faithful, loyal mouthpiece of Russia that says, you know, this report is 100% accurate and it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. I can't say that because I'm not the faithful, loyal mouthpiece of Russia. I'm just me. Normally Russia, I'm 100%, you know, I'm very much aligned with the Russian cause because it's the right cause. But I mean, I look at this report, there's no sourcing. There's no, you know, we don't know where it came from. It seems accurate. I mean, well, how do we know? Well, because Yermak meets with the Swiss National Security Advisor on a frequent basis. Zelensky has a close personal relationship with the Swiss president. They have a history of meeting in Switzerland and around. They just had a meeting, I think, July 10th in Rome. So on the surface, you're like, well, that makes sense. They could get together. We know that they've met with their British advisors. Powell, I think, is the name of the British, quote unquote, diplomat. Jonathan Powell, Julie Stiles-Steins, I don't know, the ambassador, Ukraine, charge of the affairs, maybe, they meet and talk. So when you look at all this, you're going, well, this all makes sense, except we don't have evidence that all these people traveled to Switzerland at this time. But the point is, this report is very sophisticated because this report undermines Zelensky's future as a president of Ukraine, because the Ukrainian people are being told by this report that Zelensky, who is a Western tool, is about to be replaced by Zelensky, who's a Western tool, and that the Ukrainian people don't matter, don't count. This is absolutely essential posturing for Russia, because what Russia needs is an actual election to take place in Ukraine where Russia is able to insert its alternative to this Western control. The Ukrainian people need to lose trust and confidence in the West. The Ukrainian people need to be exhausted by being a proxy to the West. And that's what this report does. Zelensky has a snowball's chance in hell of being president of Ukraine. He will never be president of Ukraine. I mean, he will never be the elected president of Ukraine. And if he's appointed by the West, Russia will make the same claim against Zelensky as they made against Zelensky. He's not the legitimate president of Ukraine, and therefore we can't do business with him. As I said, I believe the next president of Ukraine after an election will be named Azarov. I could be wrong on that. It'll be somebody like him, somebody that the Russians agree with, somebody who the Ukrainians know and understand, but not Zelensky. That's the genius of... The British may be unhappy, but the British aren't winning here. This whole experiment, this whole enterprise, this you know, adventure that they set off on is failing, and there's no way to recover. They're literally in a fighter plane. Engines are burned out, and they're in a flat spin. Their only choices are bailout or pancake and die. That's it. They're not going to recover.
Scott, what's going on with the Zangezur corridor?
I don't know.
Do you think that the rumors, because we know that Armenia is part of Armenia, is the connection between Armenia and Azerbaijan. At the border of
Unfortunately, I've got to pause for just a second because I got a knock at the door.
Okay. Yeah. Let me just, we're going to talk about, actually, I'm preparing the concept of Azerbaijan. We're going to talk about what would be the strategy of Iran and Russia in Azerbaijan, because that would, Azerbaijan connects the situation with Turkey. And we're going to go to the Middle East because I want to focus on what's going on in the Middle East right now as well. And let's see what would be the take of Scott on this, but it seems that something big is happening in Zangezur corridor, and Azerbaijan is somehow having a lot of problems with Iran and Russia. Armenia is something big is happening in Armenia. I don't know if you follow what's going on in Armenia, but we're going to see something similar to what has happened in with the case of Azerbaijan, and I want to focus on that, and then go to the Middle East. Scott.
Yeah, I was just I always have to answer the door just in case it's the FBI. It wouldn't be the first time the FBI interfered with a podcast they were running, but no, it was just pest control knocking the door. If I didn't answer the door, they just keep knocking and my dogs would keep barking. So I apologize to your audience about that. But Zang is in our corridor.
Yeah. Go ahead.
You know,
could you move the camera a little bit downward, Scott?
Sure, I can do that.
Yeah, it's better.
How's much that? Better?
Yeah, better. Much better. Go ahead.
Mike, is it Whitcomb? The U.S. ambassador to Turkey, Donald Trump's real estate pal.
Yeah, it's Tom.
Tom Braddock. Or no, Barak. Barak. That's it. Barak. Yeah, Thomas Barak. Barak.
Yeah.
He's become sort of a, you know, how Steve Witkoff appeared out of nowhere to become a special envoy of everything. Well, Thomas Barak has become the special envoy of everything. He's not only just the ambassador to Turkey, he's a special envoy for Syria and Lebanon. And now apparently he's knee deep in Armenia. He has put forward, and normally I would have dismissed this, except he admits it. He said, no, the U.S. wants to lease, 42 kilometers of a highway or 36 miles, I don't know, of a highway connecting the Nakhchivan exclave, part of Azerbaijan, with Azerbaijan mainland, carving through the southern part of Armenia. This is popularly known as the Zangezur Corridor. It's something that Armenia and Turkey have been insisting on as part of this peace process, or peace deal, because what it enables is Turkey now to go through Azerbaijan and have access to Central Asia. It's going to create this.
It's 43 kilometers.
43 kilometers. Okay. Well, that wasn't too bad. I said 42.
Yeah.
It was off by a click. For 64-year-old brain, that's not too bad. But the other thing is they were seeking to and do this by bullying Armenia, and the Armenians, of course, hesitated. And Iran stepped in, and Iran had said that they won't allow the Zangezur corridor to be formed in this way because that would create a separation between Iran and Armenia. You know, sort of a artificial border would cut Iran off from Armenia proper. And so that's where we were, but it now appears that the United States has made this offer and that Armenia is the Armenian, is it president or prime minister?
Pashinyan
or whatever. I don't know how long he can stay prime minister because he's doing everything. I mean, there was a period of time where, you know, Azerbaijan, you couldn't say Azerbaijan in Armenia without people spitting on the ground. This is the man who is responsible for losing Nagorno-Karabakh. He gave it up. And now he's conceded other territorial gains to the Azeris. And it appears it's done under some sort of, you know, promise by the European Union, NATO, and by the United States that Armenia is going to become, you know, the next greatest thing. This is the backup plan to Georgia. I mean, basically, the Republic of Georgia, a lot of pressure was put on the Republic of Georgia in the past several months, years, to open up a second front against Russia. The idea was to open it up again in Abkhazia and south of Ossetia and force Russian forces to be diverted from the conflict in Ukraine. It would have resulted in the total destruction of Georgia. Nobody cares about this tiny little nation of 3 to 4 million people. I do. My wife's Georgian, and I love Georgia. It's a wonderful country, and I'm glad that the Georgian government, the Georgian Dream Party, rallied against this and didn't take the bait. And today, they have, you know, an economy that's not hampered by sanctions with Russia, an economy that's growing, you know, 10-12% a year, and hopefully Georgia is heading in the right direction. But that's not the end of the Southern Caucasus adventures on the part of the United States. Now Armenia is being turned into a second front, and they're, you know, basically they're looking to get Russia, you know, engaged in some sort of military adventure, you know, with Azerbaijan. It's not just about creating this kind of tension, military tension. It's about destroying one of the great strategic, you know, concepts of Russia, the North-South Economic Corridor. They connect St. Petersburg with Bandar Abbas and then on to India. This was supposed to run down through the Caucasus, through Azerbaijan, into Iran. Now, it's not dead yet, I mean, because it can still go down to Astrakhan, I guess, and jump on ships and go through the Caspian Sea and, you know, land in Iran and move forward. But it was supposed to be a rail connectivity. This, and, you know, if this, the Zangezar corridor goes through, comes a point of contention and stress between Iran and Armenia, you know, what will Russia do? It's just an absolute mess. Again, it's the West. I mean, I wish I could tell the Armenia, maybe they're listening now, you're going to die. That's all that's going to happen is you're going to die. Nobody cares about you. I'm sorry to say it. You've got nothing. Literally, you've got nothing. You don't have oil. You know, your culture, I mean, you got a lot of Armenian Americans here that like you, but that's about it. Nobody cares. I mean, Kim Kardashian's butt is a national treasure, but that's about it. Nobody else cares. We don't care about you. You know, we got people that will play stupid games with Turkey, you know, to bring up, you know, 1915 and then the Armenian genocide just to piss the Turks off. But it's not as easy as that, is it, Armenia? Because you guys know what you did, don't you? You know what you did to those Muslims in that part of Turkey. You wanted the Russians to invade, and when they invaded, you turned on the Muslims and you killed over a million of them. And maybe that's why the Ottomans decided you had to get out of the border region, and they did that whole deportation thing. I mean, it was bloody. It was a mess. You know, millions died. I'm not condoning any of it, but you're not as innocent as you come out, and that's proven today. The stupidity of the Armenians is excessive. They're playing a game where they think they're going to get something. The best friend of the Armenian people is Russia. The best friend of the Armenian people is Russia. In fact, they're the only friends that Armenia has. Nobody else is their friend, because how can you like these people? They don't even like themselves. They just abandoned 200,000 people from Nagorno-Karabakh. You know, oh, yeah, sentries there. We fought a couple wars for you. Nope, you're abandoned, gone, finished, boom. Oh, the Zangezar corridor, Armenian territorial integrity. It means that, nope, gone. Why? A false hope that you're going to somehow allow Armenia to be turned into a second front against Russia. But you got nothing. You will collapse like a house of cards. It's just stupid. The Armenians are being stupid. The Azeris are being stupid too, because the Azeris have to understand that while they have energy and all that stuff, Russia can take out their pipelines in a second. I mean, it's simple. Azerbaijan's not a superpower. And, you know, everybody talks about, you know, Azerbaijan able to threaten the Azeri population of northern Iran. That sword cuts two ways. Just want to remind people of that. That sword cuts two ways. And you want to play the ultimate game of national survival, Baku could become an Iranian city if you're not careful. So this is the stupidity that's taking place here, because the West is raising the stakes in this conflict with Russia to existential proportions, together with Iran. I wouldn't have talked about Iran making a move in Azerbaijan prior to the bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities. But now we're literally in a situation where the West is threatening the with Iran with, you know, its survival as a modern nation state. And when done in that light, you can't predict the future. And that's the danger here. The Zangezur corridor isn't going to be what people think it's going to be. It's not going to turn into this thing that makes Turkey the new Ottoman Empire. It's actually 43 kilometers of vulnerability. It's not very wide. American, you know, leasing doesn't provide any guarantees of security. It can be cut in a heartbeat. And unless it's premised upon sound diplomacy that seeks, you know, peaceful coexistence and terms that are acceptable by everybody, it has no chance of survival. And it will just, its creation will only lead to conflict. Conflict that could lead to the destruction of Armenia and the destruction of Azerbaijan. It won't lead to the destruction of Iran or the destruction of Russia. That's a guarantee.
And today I talked with Professor Marandi. It seems that Iran and Azerbaijan, Iran and Russia are totally on the same page with the conflict. They know how to deal with that, but let's see what would happen. It's dangerous. It's so dangerous, especially about Armenia.
And if Armenia thinks Turkey's their ally, think again. I mean, I don't know what the game the Armenians are playing here. It's just stupid. And it's tragic because, you know, even though they're not Georgian, and even though the Georgians have a lot of reasons not to like the Armenians for the betrayal that took place in Abkhazia in 1992, 1993, there's the Christian faith. They're both ancient Christian religions, Armenian church, the Georgian church, they're fellow Christians. Their culture is similar. It's Southern Caucasus culture. You know, they go back to ancient times. They were part of the same region. They're not bad people. And they deserve a better life. They deserve a peaceful life. They deserve a prosperous life. But they're being used by everybody for purpose. The only people that don't use the Armenians are the Russians. And I don't know why Armenia can't see that. They've been infected with the same disease that Georgia was infected with in the aftermath of the Soviet Union, where Georgianism came in and everything about Russia became bad and the West was just great. The EU was great. But now the Georgians have seen the reality of the EU, the reality of the West through the non-governmental organizations that are promoting this second war, the second front. And the Georgians now are waking up to the fact that while they're proud of being Georgian and their separate cultures and everything, there we go. The only friend they got is Russia. That's all I'm going to say. I'll leave it at that. The only friend the Georgians have is Russia, and the Armenians need to understand that too. The only friend, the true friend they have is Russia. And I would say Iran to a similar extent, but historically Russia. And Azerbaijan's not their friend. They fought and lost a war. Turkey committed, you know, genocide. There's no love lost there. Why are they picking Turkey and Azerbaijan to be their allies? And why are the Armenian people allowing this prime minister to go off the rails like this? I don't know. I don't understand it.
Scott, Armenian Iranians are one of the, I would say, one of the important ethnicities, or can I say minorities in Iran. They're not minorities. They're part of Iran. They're part of Iranian culture. They've been part of Iranian culture for more than 1,000 years, and they've been there in Iran. They're part of Iran. We don't call them Armenian. We call them Christian Armenian Iranian. But after all, there is a lot of connection between Iran and Armenia. I literally, you know, we have a lot of prominent actors, singers. These are Iranians, but came from Armenia, but they feel Iranian. And there is a huge connection between Iran and Armenia. I don't know. I don't understand why the government is behaving this way. It doesn't make sense to anybody in Iran. I talk with Miranda, as I mentioned to you. They don't know what's going on in the mind of Pashinyan, the prime minister of Armenia. It's somehow, we know that from the outcome, from what we are witnessing, it's somehow it's so dangerous in the eyes of Iranians, in the eyes of Russians. And they were somehow between Iran and Russia.
Russia and Iran aren't messing around. I mean, again, they've both crossed what I call that existential red line, meaning that the path they're on is a path that can only end with national survival. That if they deviate from the path, they stop proceeding down this path, they put themselves at existential risk. Russia must win in Ukraine, and Iran must win against Israel and the collective West. I mean, and Azerbaijan exposed itself as an enemy of Iran in this last conflict. So, you know, when the stakes are that high, I don't know what game Armenia is playing right now, because they don't bring anything to their military sucks. Their economy sucks. Their nation has nothing, no heavy industry. Anyways, beating that dead horse.
Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Well, thanks for having me. And I look forward to our next conversation.
Yeah. Look forward.
Thanks.
See you soon. Bye-bye.